It's amazing to think that species can adapt to changing conditions and habitats to improve their chances for survival. Of course, it might take millions of years to get there, but the fact that there is such a richness and diversity of life here on Earth proves that it's been successful for many, many creatures. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Kimberly Bostwick is curator of the Bird and Mammal Collection in the Cornell University Museum of Vertebrates. She'll be giving the Friday evening keynote talk at the UW-Madison's Darwin Day event. Really, and she is doing some fascinating research with birds, a particular type of bird. And I'm telling you, I was watching some of her work online, and it really is fascinating. So I'm happy to have her with us today. Glad to have you listening in as well. Maybe you have some questions about evolutionary biology. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. And Kimberly Bostwick with me by phone. Kimberly, are you there?
I am. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, I'm excited to engage.
Well, I'll tell you what. You work in the field of evolutionary biology. Well, let's talk a bit first about what's covered in that area of study.
Oh, my goodness. Evolutionary biology. a famous biologist, Gaylord Simpson, once said, "But nothing in sense makes biology without the light of evolution." And so there are people who study molecules who consider themselves evolutionary biologists, people who study bones who consider themselves evolutionary biologists, people who study birds, people who study slugs, people who study, you know, you name it. If it ever lived or was part of something that ever lived, there are people who call themselves evolutionary biologists who study it.
Oh, man. And it's important. Why is it important to understand evolutionary biology?
Well, you know, there's some real pragmatic reasons. Everything from, if you understand sort of the, what would you call it, the motivating factors of how our bodies work, like our evolutionary contexts have been that we have evolved in, it's easier to understand why we may have things like health problems or why we respond the way we do to disease. So, for instance, you know, there's a dialogue in the general public now that understands that we have access to more high-fat foods than we ever would have, and high-salt foods than we ever would have historically in our evolutionary past. And our bodies don't really respond well to this new environment. Mm-hmm. We haven't adapted. And understanding evolution kind of helps put those things in context.
And would you say it's if evolution is vital to a species' survival?
Well, I think it's how would I say it? That is the default. If you don't adapt, you don't survive. Evolution is part and parcel of living, and part and parcel not only of living but as an individual, but as we go through generations, we as a group of animals or organisms going forward in time, we have to evolve. There's no other choice. We replace ourselves, and whoever comes after is different from us and survives differently. And so yes, there is no life without evolution.
Yeah. And somebody said, what actually causes, or I think there's some really interesting things here that we can discuss about those factors that cause or affect whether or how a species evolves in a particular way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just like we in our individual personal lives are subject to all sorts of forces and stresses and opportunities, so too every living creature is, and how we respond, or how an organism responds, or how a species responds, defines what its evolutionary trajectory will be. So if that's, you know, you're an animal living in the cold and it gets colder, then your species is going to have to adapt to those colder conditions, and that is the heart of evolution.
No other way.
No, yeah. Sort of locked in.
Well, and it's a process that can take, I don't know how quickly it can happen. It happened relatively quickly, but I guess, but it, sometimes it takes a million years as well. And if that's the case, how do you study it?
Right. Well, that's an interesting thought. You know, I think we, in general, are used to thinking of evolution in that occurs in millions and millions of years. I actually have an interesting example of, as you said, I curate the bird and mammal collections here at Cornell.
Yeah.
And we had a scientist come work with us from Canada, and he was measuring, you know, the chickadees and woodpeckers in our collections. And our collections have birds from 100 years, 150 years. And he was comparing the shapes of wings of common birds, like chickadees and woodpeckers, from 100 years ago or 150 years ago to the same species today from the same locations. And what he found was, even in that tiny, you know, tiny relatively speaking, 150-year yeah. interval, that chickadees and woodpeckers had modified their wing shapes. They were longer and thinner 100 years ago, when actually deforestation was at its peak in North America, and they have become shorter and rounder in the intervening decades because eastern North America has actually reforested itself as agriculture has kind of slunk back a little bit. And so here on a timeline that we can kind of understand, he could actually document changes in multiple bird species in this place that we currently live, where we feel like the changes haven't been that extreme.
That's amazing. 150 yeah. years, probably even a little less than that.
Probably less.
Kimberly Bostwick is curator of the Bird and Mammal Collection in the Cornell University Museum of Vertebrates. She'll be giving the Friday evening keynote talk at the UW-Madison Darwin Day event. We're going to talk certainly some more about that Darwin Day event and also about her own research, but visiting with her kind of in general as well about evolutionary biology and Darwin Day. You can join in with your questions or comments. What do you think? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Got an email from James in Milwaukee who says, not only do we have brains and eyes, we have conscious experiences. We see colors. We hear sounds. We feel pleasure and pain. We feel tickles, none of which exists as such in the brain or physical world. Why did consciousness evolve, not just brains? What is its function? When did it first appear, in your opinion? Well, these are small questions. Should be pretty easy to answer right away, Kim.
Yeah, so let me just right away say those are questions that, very few people would be qualified to speak really authoritatively to. But that being said, I think from an evolutionary perspectiveness, I have pondered consciousness myself. And I think I sort of see it as what would you call it? It's legislative executive body of a collective being, right? So you're an animal, and but you need some decision making, and the more you are able to sort of look over your whole situation, your whole set of circumstances, and think at a high level and digest it, the more likely you're going to have appropriate responses. So I think of it as sort of like it's your centralized center for efficient decision making, is what I imagine consciousness is. And, you know, I think the question about when consciousness evolved or appeared, I think that is such a fascinating question because, we never can experience anyone's consciousness besides our own. And with human beings, it's easy to sort of say, well, you know, I've never experienced your particular consciousness, but I give you the benefit of the doubt that you're experiencing it. At least we think that with the people we like. Sometimes we question it and people we don't like, but that's different. But then when you start talking about your pets or other animals, then we're a little more skeptical. You know, we look at them and we think, is there anything going on behind those eyes? And I personally believe that actually consciousness is ancient, that a sense of self, a sense of needing to protect, a sense of something's changing in my environment and how do I feel about it is very, very ancient. And I think neurobiology bears that out in where it resides in the brain. So maybe I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Keith in Ontario has a question. Thanks for calling, Keith. Hi.
Good morning. I'm very interested in micro evolution, but macro, I'm not at all a believer in that. And the reason, one of the things I want to bring up is you mentioned that evolution explains how humans cannot handle high-fat diets, but when you look at a lot of the research of primitive people groups that still eat traditional foods and studied across, say, families that remain on the traditional ancestral foods and then those that started eating processed foods, so to speak, in town, Dr. Weston A. Price found already in the 30s that diets that were very high in fat, like the Swiss and the that were high in dairy, the Mali Africans, high in dairy, the Eskimos high in dairy fat. Blubber from seals and whales.
Yeah.
But
mm-hmm.
It highly mineralized, very fatty foods. And their children of the families that moved to town, their teeth immediately decayed, their bone structure, their health in general. They developed diabetes, cancer, asthma that their relatives still eating the traditional foods didn't. So I would have to differ on your view of macroevolution, just even in that one simple argument you laid out.
Yeah, well, I didn't try and lay out a full-blown argument. I was trying to use sort of an example that has sort of general acceptance. And I think there's plenty of room for variance from any general rule that you're going to say about biology. That's one of the challenges of biology, right? Anytime you lay out some rule, it's like, oh, yeah, well, what about this, that, and the other thing? Diversity persists despite our efforts to simplify it. And you're absolutely right. There are really fascinating instances of people who have adapted to their local environments or situations, you know, and I think there's no doubt that, for instance, people who are of European descent are better able to deal with fat. Dairy has been a critical part of our survival to the extent that we are generally a very dairy-tolerant population of people. On the other hand, other populations of human beings, like largely Asian descent, were not exposed to and never adapted to in the same way that we did dairy foods, and therefore tend to be less tolerant of them. So, you know, yes, I spoke in a broad example to try and sort of illustrate the general principle, but I would not try and argue. I would want to go ahead and jump into the details to defend it. And I think when you get into the details, you'll see that actually there is micro or like you said, some more local adaptation to the specifics. And there's lots of examples of that sort of thing.
Yeah, so we really impact the evolution of our own species in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, I remember a point in my life where I thought, well, human beings had removed ourselves from evolution. But I came to realize that, well, actually, evolution is just differential reproduction. You know, it's differential survival and reproduction, and that still happens among us for various reasons. So, I mean, you could say there is selection against reckless driving behavior in young men because those who do it are less likely to survive. And that is like I said, that fact never goes away, that we differentially survive based on our behaviors and our propensities.
Kimberly Bostwick is a curator of the Bird and Mammal Collection in the Cornell University Museum of Vertebrates, our guest today. She's the Friday evening keynote speaker at the UW-Madison's Darwin Day event. We'll talk with her some more about that. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Kimberly Bostwick, curator of bird and mammal collections in the Cornell University Museum of Vertebrates, talking with her about evolutionary biology and Darwin Day. Just to let you know, coming up about 11:45 today, we'll visit with David Toomey. He's an associate professor and director of the Professional Writing and Technical Communications Program at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and he's the author of Weird Life, The Search for Life That Is Very, Very Different from Our Own. Fascinating book, and looking forward to visiting with him as well. But for the present, we're visiting about evolutionary biology with Kimberly Bostwick. We're going to get into some information about what she's talking about. The theme for Darwin Day this year is the mating game, and so it's a pretty cool theme, I think. And there's lots going on in association with it. Is this the first time you've spoken at a Darwin Day event, Kimberly?
No, it isn't. I actually, years ago when I was in graduate school, too many years ago, we had a similar sort of a mating game kind of Valentine's Day Darwin event at where I went to school, University of Kansas. And, boy, I have to say, though, there's nothing I love more than sort of being free to talk about some of the fun, fancy, sort of fickle parts of evolution that you get to talk about when you're talking about the mating game.
that'll give me a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, we've got Stuart in Chippewa Falls with a comment, so let's go there. Stuart, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question regarding the comment you made earlier on the recent dietary changes of humans and the diseases that have arisen from that. Since humans reproduce typically before these diseases occur, will humans still pass on the genetic code susceptible for these diseases and slow the evolutionary changes that are needed to combat these diseases?
Hmm.
Yeah, so that's a fascinating observation.
Yeah.
So when you talk about, high fat diets in general being bad for most of us, the fact is we will mostly reproduce long before, we're suffering the consequences of those problems. And that is a whole central idea in some aspects of evolutionary biology, which is this idea of senescence. And that part of the reason we senesce or age and die and have problems that we do as we age is because selection becomes weaker and weaker and weaker the further you go into your own life. That is your biggest reproductive potential starts, when you're able to start having kids or start reproducing as any animal. And but that, yes, the later things occur in life, the less likely it is to have any influence on whether or not you reproduce, and therefore selection becomes weaker. So I think that is a very astute observation, and it is a central idea in evolutionary biology, or it has its own body and understanding. And yes, part of the reason we do suffer and continue to suffer is because selection on us is acting too weakly to change us very quickly in these ways, for better or for worse.
There you go. Thanks, Stuart. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. We have some open lines, so we can get you on fairly quickly at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments, or you can email us at talk@WPR.org. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. Facebook question from George. Some people refer to microevolution, and this came up a little earlier with an earlier call, as opposed to macroevolution. Do biologists make a distinction between these two terms?
Definitely. Definitely. It's not, of course, it isn't as clear-cut as we conceive of it, because there are people who feel like they span between the two, or people who focus on one and who don't really understand what the other one is. But I think a good generalization would be a lot of people are very comfortable with the idea of differential reproduction leading to diversification. So, you know, if all of the red bacteria survive to reproduce and the blue ones die, that there's more, the species becomes more red with time, kind of, you know, that kind of level. But they don't like the idea that, for instance, that maybe that you can speciate, that, that the bacteria could become a red species and a blue species, or that the bacteria could ultimately become a multicellular organism. And I think, like we said, it's the processes that occur at the microevolutionary level that have implications for what occurs at a macroevolutionary level. And so, you know, if you add in a few more conditions from microevolution, you get macroevolution. And I think biologists very much recognize this and are very comfortable seeing sort of a continuity between the transition of micro to macro.
Right.
Do you think that answers that question?
Yeah, that was a good answer. Thank you.
Good.
Ralph and Slinger has a question. Hi, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have a historic question, which I think your guest can answer, Dr. Mueller.
All right.
In 1911-1912, the Scott expedition to the Antarctic went to great lengths to secure emperor penguin embryos. The British Museum wanted them to solve some evolutionary problems.
Mm-hmm.
Did those embryos ever solve anything or add to our knowledge of bird evolution?
Oh, did you say your name is Ralph?
Yeah.
Yes.
Ralph Slinger? Okay.
Ralph from Slinger.
Hmm. Oh, from Slinger? Okay.
Slinger, Wisconsin.
Okay.
I'm a birder.
Okay. Well, this is a very non-random question, and I feel like I'm back in grad school under the scrutiny of my grad committee, who's just... So I know what you're referencing. So let me expand upon your question. So back in the turn of the century, it was understood, misunderstood, that penguins were the most primitive of all birds. The people's idea of evolution were still being formed. We didn't have a very sophisticated understanding of evolution, but we did have an idea that some species were more primitive and some species were more evolved or more derived. And we thought sort of that those more primitive species were more representative of things that lived a long time ago. We've kind of gotten away from that. We now say if you're alive in the year 2012, you're a modern species. You may still hold on to features that were shared with more primitive things that truly existed millions of years ago, but you are not yourself primitive. If you're alive today, you are modern.
Yeah, okay.
You can have primitive features, but you cannot yourself be primitive. So people thought penguins were either primitive or shared primitive features. And the expedition was trying to get eggs of these penguins because they thought, because of this powerful idea that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny.
Exactly.
Yes, it was this idea that if you watch an embryo develop, you can see it go through the stages of its ancestors in some form. And since their birds, penguins were primitive, considered primitive birds, and there was this fascinating question about the relationship of birds to dinosaurs that actually back in that day was much closer to the view we have recently redecided today, that birds are very quite closely related to dinosaurs. People wanted to look at those eggs to see if they watched that ontogeny, if they could get further clues to see sort of like the dinosaur, the intermediate dinosaur form coming out of or occurring in the development of those penguins. So that was sort of the context. And honestly, I don't know the follow-up, like when they got eggs, how many eggs they got, what was found, and what they decided from it. I do know, in retrospect, we would now say the question was sort of malformed, that penguins are, like I said, modern birds in and of themselves, and the ways in which ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny is a more subtle question than we would probably have found in the egg. I will qualify that by saying with modern evolutionary techniques, there is still so much information in developing embryos to tell us about evolution. But I don't think it ever panned out quite the way they hoped it would back then in 1912.
Ah, there you go, Ralph. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it. Well, as long as we're on birds here a little bit, your Darwin Day talk topic is Evolution Revealed, How to Evolve a Seductive Musical Instrument from Feathers. And I got to tell you, I was just entranced by the your online at singingwings.org. And as a matter of fact, I have it up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show for people to click on and view it. That it is just fascinating what you've done and what you've looked at.
Yeah,
I love
it. Is that bird a gem or what?
Oh man! And just as an aside, as a chairman of a Department of Life Sciences Communication here at the UW-Madison, the way that you it is described and how you put that together is just fabulous.
Thank you.
Fabulous. But anyway, let's talk about that bird. Boy, there is a dandy bird. The club.
Yeah, so sort of, I think one of my missions in life is to let the world discover the clubwing mannequin.
Yeah.
Talk about an idiosyncratic little mission. But the clubwing mannequin is an idiosyncratic little small species of bird that's found in a very small range in the whole world. They're found in South America, only in northwestern Ecuador and southwestern Colombia, on middle elevations in the Andes. And if you took a photo of them, you'd see they're pretty unremarkable. They just kind of look kind of brownish with a little red head. And but they still end up being, to me, one of the most fascinating stories on the planet of evolution, especially as it relates to the mating game. So this bird makes a sound with its wings. And we know that birds make sound with their wings because everybody's familiar with hummingbirds. And if you're a bird fan, you'll probably know some other examples like nighthawks that dive or storks that clatter their bill, or, you know, birds will do all sorts of sounds with their bodies. But when this bird makes a sound with its wings, it does
amazing.
Something that's sort of, yeah, I mean, how would you describe it, Larry? I mean, you saw what it did. I mean, what was your response to that?
I looked at it and I thought, how can this bird, it lifts its wings up, almost raises it up higher than, I don't know.
Over its head.
Completely. Over its head.
But flipped.
Yeah,
the back side
it.
Is flipped over. Right.
And then you hear this tone.
Sounds like a violin.
Sounds like a violin. It's just beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Simple.
And how the heck do they do it? And, you know, of course, that's the subject of all of your work and research.
Yeah. Yeah. So you know, that was the puzzle. And, you know, the funny thing is I studied that bird, and I got video of it. I saw it in the field. I looked at its feathers and its bones and its anatomy. And about 10 years into my research on that species, I kind of decided that whatever it was doing was impossible. I kept coming up with the same answer. What I'm seeing does not make sense, and I can't explain it.
Well,
but, you know, fortunately, I've gotten beyond that.
You've gotten smarter.
Yeah. I got a little more data. Actually, what I had to do is I had to read about bugs and how bugs make sounds with their wings, or insects, you know. And then I started to realize that, actually, if you think about bugs, what they're doing with their bodies is much closer than to what this bird was doing than what this bird was doing compared to any other bird. So, you know, to jump to the, so can I tell people? Like,
yeah, you can talk about it. Yeah.
So it turns out this bird is called the clubwing mannequin because the feathers, which, you know, everybody has a sense of a feather. It's a long, slender, flat thing. Well, that central shaft of a feather, which is called a rachis, in most birds, just gets thinner and thinner as you go to the tip till it almost just sort of disappears. But in this bird, the rachis is this big, fat, club-shaped thing. Actually, I think it's more like a baseball bat-shaped thing. It just gets fatter at the end, and that's what the bird was named for. And even Darwin knew about those modified feathers. But the thing is, okay, so it's got weird feathers. It's making this weird sound. How do those two things go together? Because what happens is the bird puts its wings above its back into this really weird position, and the sound occurs, and it just happens for, like, you know, a half a second. Mm-hmm. And then the sound ends, and you don't, what did that feather do? You know, was it a horn? Did it vibrate like a tuning fork? You know, what, you know, magical, mystical powers is it summoning? And it turns out there's all sorts of incredible biology built around these structures to make the sound. The birds have muscles that can be twitched faster than rattlesnakes or hummingbirds beat their wings, and it may be one of the fastest voluntary, you know, limb sounds in vertebrates or limb movements in vertebrates. They've got like bones that are solid and gigantic to support these feathers and help emanate the sound. The feathers themselves have properties, acoustic properties, so that they very much are like tuning forks. And then the behavior, the bird has to like position its feathers relative to other feathers so that it can rub feathers over one another to induce this vibrating potential of the feather itself. So it's just like this crazy, crazy, highly evolved thing, just so the males can, you know, court females and ultimately mate.
Well, and it is really fascinating, and your singing wings .org. I hope everybody listening today goes to, well, go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You don't even have to be on a member of Facebook to do that. Just click on Singing Wings, and you are going to be fascinated by what Kimberly has found. It is really cool.
It is a jewel of the natural world. I will say that it's a little gem in the wonderful world of biodiversity that everybody should know. It should be a household name. And, Clubwing Mannequin.
And as Judith says, your thinking evolved over time.
That's
related
right.
to that bird.
That's right. That's the part two of the whole thing.
Yeah, it's really fun. Carolyn Madison, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I've been paying attention to the stories in India of the rapes, many widespread rape, but I'm also tied to that is the incredible disproportion of gender selection, so that there's now a society that has far more men relative to women, and I'm sure there's a connection between the behavior in society that has made rape acceptable. Now, I know this sounds like a far stretch from evolution, but have you ever thought about this gender selection thing that's going on in humans in China and India, and does that have any implication for the future of people in those countries? I'm sure reproduction will be affected in some way.
Yeah. Well, that's a very serious question. And, you know, at the beginning when Larry asked about, you know, the relevance of evolution or where does it play in our lives, you know, I talked about the fat example, but I think a much more sobering sets of things that you could talk about would be, you know, instances of abuse and violence. And, you know, I want to be very careful what I say in response to your question because it is a very serious subject. I would say that the first thing that has to be said is that evolution is not an ethical. It doesn't teach us. The process of evolution is blind. And so I don't think, and most wise evolutionary biologists would never try and argue that because something evolves is that it should be. What is, we don't confuse what is with what should be. And so if we acknowledge that there is some, ultimately some evolutionary component of why people do things like rape or you know, all any of a number of violent and terrible things that people do, that if it has some evolutionary component to it, that does not mean we condone it or support it or that it's healthy or, you know, all of those things. So that's the most important thing, is not to confuse those two things. But then to say that I personally, you know, speaking in my opinion as an evolutionary biologist, I think that absolutely we are motivated in ways that we don't understand. And that goes for both our best, most beautiful behaviors as human beings, but also some of our worst behaviors as human beings. And you know, part of my optimism about human beings and our potential is that we can actually learn about the motives that we don't fully understand and hopefully learn to work with who we are in ways that improves our lives just through understanding what motivates us. So I think I'll leave that question at that, unless oh, you have a follow up.
No.
That's good. There's not much you can say. I wasn't thinking so much of the evolutionary implications or reasons behind the rape, so much as how the gender selection will lead to implications for.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, the next generation.
Absolutely. Well, so there's the interesting, I would say, paradox of rape, which is that it might benefit an individual, but the thing is we as individuals are tied to our future generations as well, you know, and it doesn't benefit the mother of that got to be careful.
Yeah.
I definitely, ultimately, all of our evolution is linked in that I'm a woman, and so I have interests as a woman that may compete with interests of men. But I have a son, and I have a daughter, and I am equally invested in them and their futures. And so we as a species, men and women, are intimately tied. We can never, we are never, even though in our individual lives we feel like we are separately, we have our own interests, ultimately we all had fathers. We all have brothers, or, you know, many of us have brothers. We all are tied to the other gender as a species, and we can never escape that. And so whatever is bad for one is really bad for all of us.
And, Carol, thank you so much. And, boy, Kimberly, thank you so much. We're certainly looking forward to hearing what you have to say Friday night, 7 o'clock. You'll be here to talk about, in Madison, to talk about how to evolve a seductive musical instrument from feathers.
I'm so excited.
And I think I'm going to have a chance to see you sometime during the day on Friday, too. So.
Well, that would be great. And I encourage everybody to come out and come with your questions, because questions are always the most fun part.
Yeah, a lot of fun. We've got a good audience that tends to ask pretty good questions, too.
I'm sure.
Thanks, Kim.
Thanks a lot.
Kimberly Bostwick, curator of... the Bird and Mammal Collection in the Cornell University Museum of Vertebrates. And she's the keynote speaker Friday evening at the UW-Madison Darwin Day event. And just, I mean, and there are Darwin Day events going on across the state, as a matter of fact. I believe Whitewater, University of Wisconsin, Whitewater has an event, for example. As we think about the one in Madison, starts Thursday all day from 8 to 4. There's a teacher workshop, there are teacher resources that are going to be there. 7 o'clock Thursday night, there are some evolution shorts, Love and Sex in the Natural World, at the Union South Marquee. On Friday, then, 7 p.m., the keynote address by our guest today, Kim Bostwick, from Cornell University. That's at 7 o'clock. And Saturday from 10 to 2, the Tree of Life Exploration Stations and Scavenger Hunt activity for all ages. Kids can win prizes for completing the hunt. It's at Town Center at Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. 10:30 in the morning, a lecture by Chris Smith from Willamette University on the most repulsive tree, the most remarkable fertilization system. And then at noon, a lecture by Matt Dean from the University of Southern Cal, and talk about dolphin pelvic bones evolve in response to sexual selection. So lots going on. And as a matter of fact, up on our Facebook page, we've got the whole list of events and where you go to see them at the UW-Madison. And again, I really encourage you to take a look at... Kim Bostwick's home, Singing Wings. It's at singingwings.org. Just go on to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can click on it there. And it's in several nice bite-sized pieces where she discusses and talks about her research. And it's really fascinating. It's not only her. She's got some great video of the birds and them using their wings to make the sounds, and then how they actually are able to do it. It is really fascinating stuff, and I know you're going to enjoy it. It's fascinating, this discussion. And I'm pretty sure, and in fact, I know you're going to enjoy what's coming up next. We're going to continue to talk about evolutionary biology, but from a different angle. We're visiting with the author of a fascinating new book. It's called Weird Life, The Search for Life That Is Very, Very Different from Our Own. And when we say very different, very, very different, we really mean very, very, very different. David Toomey, our guest, coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.